You are now listening to the one and only Nancy Ruffin.
You are tuned in to the Nancy Ruffin Show, a digital global classroom where individuals across all ages, backgrounds, and career levels tune in for guidance and motivation to live life on their own terms. Hosted by award-winning author, transformation coach, and the self-proclaimed Latina Oprah, The Nancy Ruffin Show is where inspiring thought leaders, modern-day influencers, and social game changers come to discuss their own personal journeys and have real conversations about the journey to success. It's where the next generation of leaders come to tap into their potential, ignite their fire, and expand their self-awareness. So if you're ready to power up and blaze trails of positive change, then you're in the right place. Let's get started.
Welcome back. This week, I am just honored and humbled to have joining me in conversation children's author, Sulma Arzu Brown. She is an educator, she is a mother, and she is an activist. And this week, we're going to be talking about all of the injustices that have plagued our country for far too long. We're going to be talking about what it means to us specifically as women, as mothers, as wives, to Black men, and what we feel we need to do individually and collectively to eradicate this systemic racism and hatred that has existed in our country for far too long. So Sulma, thank you for joining me. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Nancy, it's always amazing to be with someone I consider so dear. We're spiritually connected. You already knew that since day one. You are light to this world, and I appreciate you just appreciating the talent that God gave you to share these powerful messages that are impactful, and more importantly, it comes from a place of love, and I've always adore that about you. So it is my blessing to know you.
Oh, thank you. You know, it's been a really tough couple of weeks, you know, and before we kind of started this conversation, you were just saying how tired you felt, how exhausted you've been. How have you just been holding up with everything that's been going on, still having to show up, you know, for your children, having to also be that pillar of strength for your husband? You know, we know that as women, you know, we take on a lot and we're expected to be the nurturers and the one who takes care of everyone else. Right. How have you been taking care of yourself during this time?
You know, you spoke about that I still had to show up, right? I think that during this time, I had to show up, be present, not just with my own emotions and my own path in this, but also be present with my husband's emotions and his path, be present with my children's emotions, their path. It just took an extra layer, because now I have to be watchful, mindful, and I feel like as a mom, we've always had to be that protector and nurturing. But I think that this period in time, we had to go even deeper and find that emotional strength to even compartmentalize our own feelings, our own path. Yeah. So if I keep on explaining, you'll know even more why I'm exhausted.
Yeah. No, it really is. So it's deep. It takes such an emotional toll. Yeah. Because you have to kind of, like you said, compartmentalize your own feelings, that you're not really allowing yourself to process the emotions and the things that are happening, because you have to, as you said, be mindful of your children and be mindful of your husband. And, you know, speaking as a woman who I too have had to kind of deal with that, I've had to be really purposeful in limiting just how much I've been working in other areas of my life. You know, because you have to show up for that too.
Yeah. And it's, and let me tell you, it's a compartment within compartments within compartments. right? And that's what how I've been feeling. And I think that I also told you earlier that I started, I'm a God-fearing woman. I love my God. And thank goodness that I started reading the book of Acts. And one of the very first things that it talks about is that Holy Spirit that he puts inside of us. So I had to be very conscious of that. Okay, he put this spirit in front of me, and this spirit is love, and this spirit is peace. And I had to get really intentional mm-hmm. about my anger flowing through this spirit, my frustration flowing through this spirit, and making sure that that spirit is my filter system, because I used to curse. I choose not to curse further, but it has been bringing this whole situation just brought out so much ugliness that I didn't know I myself have been suppressing. I thought it was done, but I realized that I have been guilty of suppressing, right? But I've also acknowledged the fact that there's another way. So remember love, remember love, remember love, right?
That's hard. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I myself, too, as a God-fearing Christian woman, mm-hmm. have been struggling with, because there is so much anger and rage. And those are all very human emotions, mm-hmm. you know, and it's normal. Mm-hmm. But as Christians, we're called to be better, right? We're called to be in and walk in the image of God. And our God, we know, was a God of love. Right. So mm-hmm. when we're witnessing these murders mm-hmm. of innocent men, when we see someone like George Floyd mm-hmm. be detained in the way that he was because of a counterfeit $20 bill, to see a knee to his neck mm. for 8 minutes and 40 seconds where he's calling for his dead mother. Mm. That in and of itself is going to trigger emotions that we probably didn't even know we were capable of mm. feeling, a different level of anger, a different level of rage. And then when we see a justice system,
right,
that doesn't acknowledge that, mm-hmm. right? Then it gets amplified. So my question is, how do we then channel that back to come back to a place of love? We're really called now to operate and function and walk mm-hmm. in this place of love when we're experiencing all this pain and anger.
You know, I think that one of the ways to do it, and one of the ways that I've been intentional, I love the word, obviously, intentional, is to understand that miracles just didn't happen back then, right? Mm-hmm. Miracles are constant. Just every morning when I wake up, I have to give thank you for waking me up. Thank you for waking my daughter, my husband up, my friends up today. And I know that waking up, it's just, I watch my husband even before this opened, right? Because coronavirus gave us the time to really reflect and see things more. So he was sleeping, ahí roncando, and all of a sudden he's awake, right? And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so miraculous. Like how the breath can make you alive again, equivalent to wake you up. Mm. Right? So when I saw, before I also say this, I wanted to acknowledge the fact that, you know, it's a miracle that the whole entire world had no choice but to be still. Globally, you know, through COVID-19. And I would always say during this time, I hope that people take the time out to reflect, to bring out the better part of them. If you didn't go to school before, do it virtually now. If you wanted to start exercising, go to YouTube and start it now. Eating healthier, you have the opportunity to, like, you have so much opportunities to do so many things now that we were made to be still. Right. And then I go to the part where me and my friend Maria were discussing. I'm like, oh my God, every knee will bend. Mm. Right. And this will not stop until every knee bends. And what did we see shortly after? A knee bending, a white cop's knee bending on the neck that took away the breath.
Wow.
Of George Floyd. Okay. But how did And it's just so, I'm just watching God's miracle, right? Because then I'm just like, I see, I can't breathe everywhere, globally. And not just white people coming, not just black people coming out, but white people coming out. I mean, knees were bending in Germany and Syria. So when I see this unity come out and every knee literally bending now, that's God's power. That is love.
Yes.
That is love. And he used the man that appeared to be a nobody, okay, to the eyes of this a society that only sees things and full of vanity, to show us the how important breath is.
Yeah.
And how important each human life is, despite of where you come from. He never used the Pharisees.
Right. Right.
He used the lowliest of people, the leper, the Samaritan woman, the prostitute. Like, this is biblical, right? And I'm not even sure if this show is about, but I can't help but to speak spirit to spirit with you, Nancy.
Absolutely. Let me tell you, this is what we're about. Mm-hmm. We're about being able to identify and talk about how God's hand is in everything, in every atrocity, right? In every joyful moment, in every miracle, God's hand is in that. I mean, and we've seen it historically in the Bible.
So you talk and
say what you need to say, okay?
Yeah, because now, you know, and it's crazy how after now every knee is bent, we're opening up again to go back to work, right? Right? It's opened up.
Right.
But not till every me bent.
Yeah, you know, and one thing I have to say, I think about George Floyd's death that we haven't seen with, for example, like other deaths. You know, we saw Philando Castile be murdered on Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. Alton Sterling, you know, young Tamir Rice, most recently, Breonna Taylor, even as impactful as all of those deaths and murders were, what we're seeing with George Floyd is the humanity, I think, that everyone is recognizing the inhumane way that he died. Because it was unnecessary. That excessive use of force wasn't necessary. And it was captured on video for all of us to see. Because had we not had the video, I don't think that the outcome and what we're seeing right now would have come to pass. I think the fact that we can see it and we don't have anyone, because what happens when they kill black people, you know, when police kill black people, they dig up any dirt that they possibly can to defame this person's character, as if to say that, oh, well, because you did this or you did a crime 10 years ago, you know, or even if you did a crime now, you deserve to die. And the truth is, no one person has the right to take another person's life. And that's just it. But what we're seeing with George Floyd is that they haven't dug anything up. You know, they're finally starting to see that this happens to everybody, well, to every black person, regardless of what their past is. And in this case, he didn't have any sketchy past to report. And so now it's become this this cry for justice, and people are disgusted now. Now we see politicians, you know, really standing up and denouncing police brutality, where we've never seen that before. We've seen police departments denounce it. We're seeing police chiefs, you know, get out there and say, this is wrong. We have to do better.
Yeah. Again, this time gave the people the opportunity to reflect. And so much good came out of this. So much good came out of this. You touched on so many points. I'm like trying to figure out which one I should address. But even with his past, they're still trying to dig up some dirt. I think that our generation and generations older than us aren't realizing that our Black, brown, and white kids are actually getting along and dancing together on something called TikTok. Right. So it's like, wait, we're supposed to be having fun together, right? Why is this happening? So even the generation before ours is not tolerating it. I'm like, what are you talking about? You hate the kid I just danced TikTok with and had a competition. You know, so they are getting along. Right. It's us as adults, right, that are still trying to figure this out. And it went deep for me, right? It went so deep to the point that all we asked for day one was to arrest the other three cops.
Right.
It was just a simple ask, because had it been a white man with three other brothers watching, though, all of them would have been arrested immediately until due process. I don't care what your law says, okay? These police officers got to go back home,
right?
Okay, back home to their families to reflect,
yeah,
and figure and cover up.
Yes.
And come up with a story together before due process. And then a couple of days later, we see looting in the stores. And all of a sudden, the attention of those who would not have been paying attention otherwise went to the looting. Oh, my God. Look at the looting. Look at the looters. And I just want everyone to know that the looting never took my attention away from systemic racism.
Right.
So the question that we have to ask ourselves is, why did the looting take yours?
Right.
Because it never took my attention. As a matter of fact, I'll take it a step further. I think we need everybody. We need the protesters. We need the silent protesters. But if the looting wouldn't have happened, I want to dare to say the TV cameras would not be on the peaceful, like it would start simmering down.
Right.
So I think everyone has a part to play. So I am grateful for the peaceful protesters. But man, I am grateful that the looters kept the attention, or brought in the attention, of those that value property more than human life, so that they could now start paying attention to the conversation as well.
Absolutely. And I think that it's important, mm-hmm. and you mentioned this, you know, that why was it that they started paying attention once the looting started? And I think that a huge problem in this country is the fact that we, you know, it's a capitalistic country, and we place so much value on the dollar, you know, and on money and on profits and on property. But what they failed to realize that the looting was just a symptom of a bigger cause. You have to look at what caused the looting, because people didn't start out looting. Okay, they started out peacefully protesting. And then when they felt like they weren't being heard, or where their demands weren't being met, or, you know, that's when the looting started, because now they have to make people pay attention. And you're not going to pay attention until there's destruction. And it's unfortunate. And I want to be really clear here for whoever is watching, you know, whoever's watching this or whoever's listening, you know, I never condone any kind of violence. You know, so I'm not here sitting in support of it, but I, as a woman of color, as a woman who's married to a Black man, as a person who has Black people in their family, I will tell you that if I had to sit and watch a loved one of mine be murdered on television by an officer, and the demand to have all of the perpetrators arrested not be heard, I am going to do whatever I feel I need to do until that justice is served. And if that means burning down buildings, that might be what, you know, what I do. If it means destruction of property, listen, when someone is hurt and when someone is in that state of rage and anger, unless you've been there, like you don't know what that feels like. You don't know what it feels like to demand justice and feel like your voice is not being heard.
Right.
And once that happened, right, then they started to pay attention, like you said.
Yeah, yeah. Let me tell you, hurt is deep. And, you know, I don't really tell this story a lot to people, but my first daughter, her biological father got assassinated while on vacation in New York City. He didn't even live in New York. He lived in Honduras at the time. And it was the pain that I felt inside was I was in my godparents' house, and I started like, I think I flipped over a table. You know what I mean? Like, I was just like, no, like I was ripping things up.
Right.
No, like nothing can live near me. I just, and that was my reaction.
That was your outlet. That was the way that you were getting the anger out.
Right.
You have to get it out.
Right. And then it's crazy because, you know, I had to fly back to New York, and we were supposed to, the police were making me feel like, don't worry, we'll find his killer. We'll find his killer. I went to the police station, and all I saw was a wall full of reward money. If you have, I think it was $5,000, or if you have information on the killing on any of the brothers, right? And it was a wallpaper full of black men's faces. And I'm like, they're never gonna find who killed them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Lennon's picture will now be posted on one of those, and he'll just become another
unsolved murder,
right? But this was not the case. We knew who did it. You know, we knew. We have an 8 minute and 40 plus, like almost 9 minute videos of camera. We know who did it. And we're telling you who did it. You're seeing who did it. And let me tell you, I want your permission to read this poem that I wrote that was on the eighth day of them not still, actually the eighth day they arrested the other three police officers, but I didn't find out till, you know, later on that day. But this was in my heart the night of the seventh, and I wrote it out day eight, right? And I want to tell you how deep I went. One of millions of black people, millions of black mothers. And this is how deep I went. And it's called, "You Drank My Baby's Milk." You drank my baby's milk. My bosom swelled as I carried the child of my black man. A baby made with love. A baby made with my black womanhood reserved for my black men. The black man I had to hold high and strengthen deep every night, because you beat him, abused him with your intent to kill him and leave our love child fatherless. Yes, those were your intentions. Yet he found the energy to come home to me, to make love to his black woman. And together we made a beautiful baby. As scary as it was, our love will help our child survive. But as soon as our baby came out, damn, yours came out too. Even though your bosom produced milk, you called me in to give your baby milk, to make your baby strong enough to kill mine. I had to share the nipple that belonged to my child. Oh God, no washing in the world could erase that pain. I had to be stronger, saying sorry to my baby day after day after day. How do I say sorry to a baby that just wants milk from his mama to grow, to breathe, to stay alive? As I fed your child, I heard mama, mama, and I could not answer, but I kept hearing mama, mama. I hurt, he needed me, I couldn't go, and oh, did I need him. I couldn't go, a pain so deep, so deep, to know that my baby would be killed by someone who was drinking his mama's milk. A pain so deep, and you didn't even do right by my milk. The milk that was a byproduct of my love for my black men, for our black child. Yet, we are willing to forgive you. We are willing to still love you, because we know deep inside our milk is good. We know our milk was made with love. But you already knew that, didn't you? But today, I share it willingly on our terms, on my terms. So drink knowledge with me. Drink truth with me. Drink love with us. Stop killing our babies. And because I am historically your baby's mama, I'll take it from here because, man, you have failed my milk.
Wow. That is such a powerful, powerful piece, Sulma.
And that was day 8 that I wrote it out. And I'm not sure if you heard of something called wet nursing. This is historical. Mm-hmm. The white women will take the slave women who had just had a child to bring them in to breastfeed their babies. So while we were giving the milk, and they knew our milk was good, and they knew how long our milk was good for, 3 months after this amount of time, after a certain amount of time, the milk loses its potency, so they'll replace the wet nurse mommy with another black slave's breast, okay? While our babies were dying.
Wow.
So I went back in time, and I'm just putting myself in that position of that mother that was breastfeeding the white woman's child that was to eventually kill hers.
Yeah. That is so powerful. I don't mean to cut you off, but just visualizing that, just having that vision in my mind when we think about, you know, slavery and what that was during that time, the fact that you are nourishing, or, you know, that they're nourishing this white child who will eventually grow up to, yeah, in essence, murder their own child. So powerful.
That's where I went on the 8th day. So when I see all of this stuff going on and people like still continuing to attack my communities and my men and calling them thugs, and I go straight to that. And I'm like, you don't even understand how deep they are going. If I went this deep in 8 days and all we asked you to do was arrest the 3 men, how deep do you think each and every one of their experience, how deep do you think they're going?
Right.
For you to still prejudge that emotion. I'm grateful to them.
I mean, as a community, as a country, like, how do we evolve past this, right? I mean, because it's been hundreds of years, hundreds of years, and we are still, you know, fighting for the right to live, for the right to breathe. You know, like, at what point does it end, man? At what point do we not have to worry about our children or our husbands, that, right, you know, that people will recognize the beauty in what it is to be black, and also recognize that blackness is not a threat any more than anyone else. There's good and bad in every race, in every culture, in every ethnicity, in every industry. I mean, there's just, you know, it's
human nature.
Right, exactly. We are just, we live in a community, in God's creation, that's good and evil. And that's what it is. And not everyone that we encounter is a bad person. So at what point are they going to stop seeing every black person as a bad person? Because that's what it is. Every time they see a black person, they automatically believe that they are criminal, that they're doing something with bad intentions, that they are bad. And the truth is that there are more good black people then there are bad, just like it's true for any other race.
You know what for me, like, what is the solution? What I think, the same way that we were inundated with books that were not written by us, right? I think that at this time, it's important for us to choose the path of education. You already know that I'm the author of Bad Hair Does Not Exist, Pelo Malo No Existe. And it has been stereotyped as a book for Black little kids, Black little African girls to be exact, quote unquote, okay? It's a book about hair. That's what I've been stereotyped with. And I wrote it for the Black hair movement. Mm. That is how when people even see
right.
Black characters on books, on the cover of books, we are immediately judged by the cover of by the book's cover. Not by when we have been patient enough to have our kids and the books that we read, right? We had to look at the white princess by the context of her character and use our imagination to imagine ourselves as princesses.
Yes.
Okay. And it goes so deep that the first Black Disney family was the Lion King. They couldn't even humanize us.
Yes. Yeah.
Because it is more comfortable to look at animals than look at a Black person as a queen and a king.
Right. You're so.
Are you tuned in? Because I am. It's the Nancy Ruffin Show.
So what I want to tell your audience that if you have white friends, if you have a school that's predominantly white in your neighborhood, if there is a birthday in your family, get them books from our community. Get them Pelo Malo No Existe. Get them Bad Hair Does Not Exist. It should be a first read to everyone because it's a book that talks about the human experience, all right? When you open up the book, you see a little girl celebrating her birthday and a friend giving her a present. That is a human experience. You see grandma teaching her granddaughter how to make cupcakes. You pass on tradition. That is a human experience, okay? So we need to start being comfortable with giving birthday cards with Black images, even though they don't reflect the family you're giving it to.
Right.
Because how long have we had to settle? How long did the illustrator of my book, Isidra Savio, she is one of the most beautiful dark-skinned Nubians, sisters that I know. Her baptismal card was of a cute little blonde baby with blue eyes. And that is why she makes cards with Nubian images so that no parent ever has to do this for their children. And I've had fair-skinned Latina friends, and I'm like, oh, it's your friend's birthday. Maybe you want to give them my book. Oh, no, I don't know. I don't know how they're going to feel about it. I'm like, it's a children's book.
Right.
Yeah, but I don't want to make them feel uncomfortable. What's so uncomfortable about a children's book with pretty colors and an activity at the back? So we need to look inside ourselves. I had a white friend of mine ask me, Suma, are you in the protest? And I said, no, I'm not out there in the protest because each and every one of us has a role to play. Mm-hmm. Okay. My role is in the classrooms. So what I'm going to do is hit the streets and go into white schools and teach through my books.
Yeah.
And she's white. And she's like, oh my God, but you're going to do it with love, right? And I'm like, I'm a children's book author and I'm a mom. What makes you think I'm not going to do it with love? So why are we so afraid of even having Black teachers in white schools?
Right.
When we have welcomed white teachers to teach our children.
Right.
As a matter of fact, we have been fighting for more teachers of beautiful colors. Okay, so I need people to understand that we are in this together and it starts with our children. Racism is taught. Let's unteach them by embracing books that will help them be friends. I want to be the ones to introduce your children to our community in such a beautiful human experience type of connection, not with a white man's knee on a black man's neck. That's not a good way to teach our kids.
Right, and I think that it's important to emphasize just how critical the education really is, right? Because it's, as you stated, racism is taught, hate is taught. Nobody is born hating. No one is, you know, born being a racist. You put two babies, you know, one black, one white together, they are going to play. They're going to embrace each other. It's a human thing to do that, because we are created and born out of love. It's our human nature. We learn how to hate. You know, all of that is taught. And I think that until we get back to the teaching, you know, and the educating, that if we do enough of that starting now, that eventually we won't even need the protests, right? Because we will get to a point where we have eradicated racism, where people start to really see each other based on, you know, who they are, based on their heart, not based on the skin tone.
Right.
And so it's important to just make that distinction, because I think a lot of people feel that if you're not on the front lines, if you're not holding up the signs, and if you don't have your fist up, you know, and if you're not marching, that you're not being part of the movement. But there's so many ways to engage and to participate. And I think the education is one of the most important ways to do that.
Yeah, and education, not just to our black kids, right? But also, please make sure that schools are educating white kids on their white history, because it's been suppressed and sugarcoated for so long that when they come face to face with it, it's a defense mechanism. They themselves express discomfort with talking about it. Right. And that is not healthy for a mind, heart, soul, or spirit. Right. It's a matter of understanding your history the way we have been understanding our history. And it's a way of understanding that their grandfathers, their ancestors' sins is not their sin. But if you are not coming face to face with your own history, there's no way you're going to be able to understand it and release it.
Right.
To make sure you don't repeat it. Right? You must understand it, because the more you suppress it, you know, Black Lives Matter is going to go on. Movements is going to go on. Black Wall Streets will be in every city in America. Let's make sure the white community doesn't feel threatened by us. Well, and decides to repeat history again.
But that is the issue. And I think that is why we see so much of the racism and the hatred, because you know, white America feels like they're losing their power, they're losing their privilege, you know, and that is something hard for people to do. They feel like their wealth is, you know, being taken from them, you know, not recognizing that we live in a world of abundance, that there's so much, there's so many resources available, that there's no reason for them to feel as if, you know, a black person succeeds, it's somehow diminishing or taking away from what they have or what they're contributing to. Like, everyone has a right to live a good life. They deserve, you know, the access to the same opportunities, to the same resources, but historically that has not been allowed because of the foundation that this country was built upon. It was built on the backs of the enslaved blacks that were brought here from Africa, specifically, you know, to build the country, to make it wealthy, you know, to work the land. You know, black people are the ones who built the country, and it was specifically created, our constitution, even with as many rights that we have a bunch of amendments, right, that had to be added after the original constitution was created, because we recognize that original constitution was not written for the black person.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you're here, I mean, education is key, man. I mean, when you go as far enough, even in business practices, to write in clauses that it's okay for employers not to hire you because of your hair, exactly. Specifically braids, afros, dreadlocks. That is
racist.
That is a lot of work to bring a whole entire nation, community of nations, based on color and hair. That is a lot of, wow, you study us, right? But if you keep on studying us, you never get a chance to study yourself.
Right.
Which means you never change.
Right, because what point are they holding up the mirror, right? And they're looking at themselves, and they're looking at how they are individually contributing to this system that has been historically built to oppress Black people and keep Black people down. Like, right. it's not a lie. We're not making it up. It's in the history books. It's part of our history.
Yeah. And if you don't have enough, if you don't have enough people like Jill Abrams, the white lady who teaches her own community on their own, we need more of her.
Right.
Because when it comes from us, there's a problem with our tone. There's a problem the way we say it. If we say it too nicely, if we say it too aggressively, there's a problem with everything. But if you get somebody like her to say it to her own people, like, it has to be taught, not from a KKK perspective.
Right.
Right? But if you, the way we teach our community comes from a place of love. Like, teach it from a place of love with the end result to be human connection. Right, that is so key. There's an opportunity for all of us across the board to be educated. And I want to talk to you just really quickly, touch on the fact that I am a Garifuna woman, right? I am from Honduras. We're the Black Caribs, and part of the reason why we survived because my people fought for the Second Carib War in the island of St. Vincent and the Grenadines. And it wasn't until they killed our chief that we waved the white flag. So the goal for my Garifuna people was genocide. So 5,000 of us were sent to a nearby island to pretty much only reptiles can survive in that island. So half of my population perished, okay? They put us on 11 convoy ships. What was the purpose? Slavery. The Americas to be enslaved, to be sold to slavery. That is documented in the British archives. You know what ended up, the reason why we ended up in Honduras? Was a shipwreck, okay? An accident was what, a divine intervention, was what kept us from having the same exact histories as my African-American brothers and sisters. And I come to this country in Honduras, I'm Black. We just had the first Black mayor of a major city after 100 years, okay, in Honduras. And the white former mayor refused to shake his hand, because he would not shake the hand of a Black man. So when I come over here, although I am grateful for being born in a Latin country, when I came over here, I am guilty of preferring to assimilate myself under the umbrella of Latina because Black was bad.
Mm.
And for that was deep for me. That was very deep for me. And the fact that I never said thank you to my African-American brothers and sisters. And instead, I came here to prejudge them too, knowing I myself was Black and I was still trying to run away from something. So thank God for the term Afro-Latina, because then it gave me an excuse to embrace the Afro. Okay, so all of this was going through my mind through this whole entire process. And I want to use this show to say, and every platform, to say thank you to my African-American brothers and sisters. Thank you for always being on the front lines for us, to give my family the opportunity to reconnect with you. And I'm sorry it took us so long to say thank you.
You know, that's powerful, Suma, because I think that is something that is pervasive in the Latino community. You know, they have a really difficult time accepting and claiming their Blackness. And that's across like all Latino countries, islands. It's something that I have experienced within my own family. My mother is, you know, a Black Puerto Ricana. Like, her whole family is Black. My uncles, aunts, my grandfather, you know, they're all Black. But they too preferred to embrace their like for lack of a better word, their Puerto Ricanness. You know, they would never say I'm black. No, yo soy puertorriqueña, I'm Puerto Rican. And they connect so much with their culture that it's easier for them to identify with culture than it is for them to identify with race. And I think that that is true, specifically here in the United States, because, you know, to attach another layer to that, African Americans also make it difficult for other blacks to claim their blackness because they feel that only African Americans are black. If you're black and you speak Spanish, you're not black. You can't claim black because your experience has not been that of what it is to be African American in this country. But the reality is, when we're getting stopped by the cops, a black is a black is a black. It doesn't matter if you speak Spanish at home, doesn't matter, you know, if you speak Creole, like whatever your language, whatever your culture is, in this country, it doesn't matter. Are black, you are black. And that's it. It's that plain and simple.
As my mom would say, punto y aparte. But it is so true. And I think, again, it goes back to education. I think that our African-American community may have also processed out of fear because it was their life that sacrificed for so many resources we come to benefit from.
Yes.
So they act out of fear. It's a process. Yes. But now that we've all gone through our process and met here, how are we going to go to the next level or the next chapter being less ignorant of each other, making a conscious decision to learn our history? Because when I go to speak to my African-American extended family, they welcome me back after I tell my history. It's like, wow, we didn't know that. We didn't know that the first black play in the Americas was called The Drama of King Shadoway in 1823 by a man named Henry Brown. That is our shared history. All right, Chief Joseph Chatelier was the chief of the Garifuna people, and it was the man from St. Vincent that wrote that play. The African American community doesn't know that part of their history, and we just learned it.
Right.
And that's one of our many connections, you know. So we have to bring it back to like, yo, at what point did we separate, my brother, my sister?
Well, that's what they've done in this country. That, you know, historically they've done that, you know, to keep us separate, because if we're separated and we're fighting each other, then we're not focusing on the real problem and fighting the real issue, which is the oppression, white supremacy.
So I say I am
divided and fighting each other.
Yep. And enough is enough. It's a wrap. You know, I'm saying we're back together again, and families first.
Yes, exactly. And that's important to acknowledge, because we need our black men in our black families.
Yeah. Yes.
We cannot continue to exist if they are continuously killing our men.
Right.
You know, and we have to protect them because they are the nucleus of our families. Because we lose our husbands, we lose our men, then what do you have? Now then you have single mothers. Right, and now you have single mothers trying to play both roles, trying to raise children, having to go out and work, and you know, and sustain the family, and it's difficult. And so we're never going to obtain that wealth, you know, that we can pass down generationally when all we're doing is living day to day trying to survive. You know, and the way that you break people down is you break down the family.
Exactly. That's why, you know, we even spoke about allies, right? And when I think of ally, I immediately think of white people. They're now our allies. Allies. But I like what Cuomo used, like camaraderie, something like that. But anyway, I am very weary. I appreciate it, but history has taught me to be very weary of allies. The reason why is because when the whole civil rights movement started, it was, you know, it was going amazing, obviously. And then shortly after, the women's rights movement started. So a lot of our black women left our black men on their own. And we went on the side of a movement that was created by white women who were our allies. Mm. And because they talked, we could be women, we left our black men wide open for divide and conquer.
Mm. Yes.
So we have to be very mindful this time around that though we are grateful for our allies, I am grateful for our allies because I feel like with our allies, we go from minority, which is a word I hate because it's systematic, right? Mm-hmm. To now with our allies, we are officially the majority worldwide,
right.
Globally. Right. You know, so it's one of those things that this is an opportunity. You know, with all due respect, my white brothers and sisters, we need this time to rebuild us. You know, please don't create anything for us at this point, although we're going to need your support, but we'll tag you in. Right. We will tag you in. We just need this time to be able to do that.
I mean, and what they really
It's a hard thing to hear, and it's really hard for me to say. But I say with love and respect, we just need our time. Let us process this.
Right. I mean, and I think that it's important for white people to understand that, mm-hmm. yeah, we need them to dismantle the system, but they also have to be willing to listen and also mm-hmm. ask, like, mm-hmm. how can I support you? What mm-hmm. do you need from us? Instead of coming yes. in like they've traditionally done, you know, with like a savior complex, you yeah. know, like we don't need saving.
Yeah.
What we need yeah. is the opportunity, you know, to create our lives, the lives that we deserve.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we need systems in place that support that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. So vote for the systems that we're going to create to have a better together, a better tomorrow. Right. Please don't create another world vision. Please don't do that to us during Black Lives Matter right now. Right. And also I'll ask, you know, our Black and Brown and Latino, like just also be conscious of what organizations you're going to be donating to. Please, let's be smart about it. Go into their boardroom, find out who started it, who's making the rules. What are their bylaws?
Right.
Because if it's so, if it's not, if it doesn't look like us, it's not spearheaded by us, by us being somebody that looks with my complexion, or please just go back to Black Lives Matter and donate there.
You know, it's yeah. interesting that you say that, and I know we have to wrap up soon, but yeah. I want to just add this, because now more than ever, we see in a lot of big name companies, organizations, mm-hmm. diversity and inclusion is a huge thing. They have, you know, specific departments now, mm-hmm. You know, specifically for diversity and inclusion.
Yeah.
And I have a friend, I'm not going to say who she works for, but they have a diversity and inclusion program that is not very diverse or inclusive, you know, talking about when we're looking at who their members are and what the council is. And so for me, diversity and inclusion is more than just having a department that you're saying is focusing on that, you know, but who are your real leaders? Like, what does the C-suite look like? Who are the ones that are in positions, you know, of power that really are empowered to make decisions? Like, how many people of color are there? It's mm-hmm. not enough to say that you're focusing on diversity and inclusion to bring in mid-level talent. What mm-hmm. does your senior leadership look like? What does,
yeah.
you know, like that's what we really want to look at, because it's at that level that we need the representation. We need people who look, you know, like us or like you at the top, you mm-hmm. know, who could really steer the organization and make decisions for the organization that are representative,
mm-hmm.
you know, of society as a whole, you know, because we don't live in a world that is just white people
mm-hmm.
and we don't live in a world that's just black. I mean, I want to see, you know, when I'm talking about diversity and inclusion, I want to see black people. I want to see brown people. I want to
yes.
see Asians, you know, I want to see
yes.
everyone
yes.
all across the board being representative if you want to really speak to true diversity mm-hmm. and inclusion.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. And also those people who are in corporate America that do have a diversity and inclusion, find out what's the budget for diversity and inclusion. Because I'm sure you know that when we come in and speak, it comes out of, a lot of times it comes out of the diversity and inclusion budget. And trust me.
And it ain't that much.
It is not. It's nothing, because we keep getting cut. Once I say say yes and they approve my price, for some reason they can't buy the books. For some, the budget just keeps going down to the point that it's like, Dad, it's important for me, pobrecito, déjame ir. And I'm, you know, and I'm just like, because they put a Black person in front of me so that I'm just like, I can't say no to a sister. I got to keep this moving because I probably.
But this is why for people like us specifically who really go out there and we have, you know, that our services are sought, you know, to come in and to speak and to do work with organizations, mm-hmm. we have to set our prices yes. and demand that they meet them. And if they don't, we have to place the value because yes. if it was a white person, they Ooh. Find that money to pay them.
Yep. Yep.
You know, and so we have to learn to be comfortable mm-hmm. with saying no.
Right.
And regardless, mm-hmm. you know, if we're saying no to another person of color, mm-hmm. you know, and then we have to express it. This is what the value of my time is. And yeah. I recognize that you're a person of color and I know you're in a tight spot, mm-hmm. but you need to then go back and relay to the powers that be that, mm-hmm. you know, there's a certain expectation and you have to be willing to pay what a person is worth. And they don't determine our worth. We determine our worth.
Because mm-hmm. if they don't have that uncomfortable conversation and if we don't have it first,
right.
then they won't be able to have it. And then it keeps changing.
And that's how you start holding those organizations, you know, you put their feet to the fire in that way. You start holding them accountable for when they say we're diverse and we're, you know, inclusive and we're bringing in, you know, speakers of mm-hmm. all different races. Because I will tell you, a lot of times I get tapped to come in and speak to organizations, but you know when I get tapped to speak? When it's Hispanic Heritage Month.
You said it. Hispanic Heritage Month, and again, because I check a couple of boxes, yep. Women's History, Black History Month. Oh, Black History Month has been also iffy.
Right.
Are you really Black, but you're from Honduras? So it has been like a battle. And this is about the human experience. We are relevant day and night, January to December, 24 hours a day. The human experience is always relevant.
Yes.
And we don't have to wait for a month to make that significant.
Oh, Suma, thank you so much for this conversation. We touched on so many different issues. things that I didn't even plan to talk about, we talked about. And all of it, very necessary, very relevant. And I'm just so grateful that you agreed to come on, that you were as honest and as transparent and authentic as you were. And I just appreciate you. I appreciate our sisterhood. And I just look forward till this whole pandemic is over and we can get together in real life and really do some incredible work together. Thank you so much.
Listen, I'm so grateful that you took the courage to have this platform. I'm so grateful that you extended, you know, your hands to me and we were able to hug it out. Again, it's a spiritual connection with you. It's a heart and soul thing. Mm-hmm. I'm so proud of all of your accomplishments. I am not surprised of any of it because of the spirit in which you go about it. You will forever be in my prayers. I love you so much.
I love you so much. You're a powerful voice. I mean, we could go back and forth with say how much we love each other and how much we admire each other, but that's what happens when two souls come together, right? They yeah. say that you attract who you are.
Right.
So I'm not even surprised that we have the connection that we have, and it was instantaneous from the moment that we got connected, and we've been connected for years now, and our relationship continues to get stronger.
Yeah.
You know, and for that, you know, to my viewers and to my listeners, I just want to express, be who you want to connect with, because who you are is the energy that you're giving out there, and that's the energy you're going to attract back to you. So always operate with integrity, always operate from a place of love, and if you do that, you will begin to see that those who are not aligned with your energy are going to drift away from you, and then you're gonna attract those to you who are aligned with who you are and with who you want to be. So be intentional about the energy that you put out into the world. And as hard as it is, in this current climate to operate from a place of love, I challenge you to do that. Because with love is the only way we're going to eradicate the hate that we have in this country. Mm-hmm. So next time, thank you guys for tuning in.
Thank you for listening to the Nancy Ruffin Show.